I was not aware of the Tulsa events of 100 years ago until I found a volume about it at a used bookstore. Around that same time, some 35 years ago, I was part of a non-denominational ministry team providing emotional support sessions for inner city families. I was working as a physician educator in Evansville, Indiana, where resident doctors provided much pediatric and obstetric care for underprivileged inner city families and mothers. I could not readily grasp why those families had such limited access to health care and other resources. Later, during my time in Evansville, I came across the history of the 1903 race riot, quote unquote, and how it drove out much of the human resources, which were considerable, from the Black neighborhoods. The majority of Black lawyers, business people, physicians, and educators departed. And then it hit me hard how the violence of 80 years past still left deep scars for individuals, communities, and families. I realized after this reflection that I too had grown up in another Indiana city with scars. In 1930, Marion, Indiana had one of the last public lynchings in the USA, attended by a mob of 10 to 15,000 by current estimates of the time. A photograph of that terrible event inspired the writing of lyrics for Billie Holiday's anti-lynching song, Strange Fruit. My father worked at the VA Medical Center in Marion and was very clear about his respect and support of African-American employees there and his positive experience side by side with Black GIs in World War II. Tulsa and so much other community violence toward African-Americans illustrates the repeated failure of the US majority and its elected officials to affirm the rights, resources, and achievements of African-Americans and their communities. This has left a strong sense of how we collectively continue blaming the victims of these destructive events of the past 160 years and more, as if they brought about their own economic difficulties and losses. Reviewing the past underscores how Black accomplishments matter, but were not affirmed and protected by the US society as a whole. We cannot make progress toward healing if we cannot endorse the achievements and the post-traumatic survival of our Black neighborhoods and families. I cannot imagine how I could mobilize sufficient personal and spiritual resources to survive what those neighborhoods and families suffered for centuries. My professional organization, the American Psychological Association, last year had an obituary that caught my attention and my appreciation. Professor Olivia Hooker died at 103 years of age, one of the last survivors of the Tulsa massacre. Her life was productive despite her early trauma of seeing her home and neighborhood destroyed in murderous fashion. She was the first African-American woman to serve in the Coast Guard, which named a building after her to honor her distinguished service to the Coast Guard and her wonderful efforts serving and helping others. Despite disparaging comments about her intelligence, she completed her PhD and served as a professor at Fordham University for 22 years. She worked with the Tulsa Race Riot Commission and testified in Congress concerning restitution for Tulsa survivors. She was honored by President Obama for her efforts to pursue justice and equality. Her story, one among so many, affirms how resilience brings forth strengths of character and powerful mentoring of others. May it always be so.
Telling the untold stories to promote equity and justice. May 31st and June 1st, just a little bit more than a week ago, mark the 100th anniversary of one of the worst massacres in U.S. history, and certainly the worst in the 20th century. Now, we have to remember that this was part of an intense climate of racial terror throughout the U.S. in the early 1920s. The Ku Klux Klan had grown in popularity both in the South and the North, and were actually major parts of holiday parades, like 4th of July parades and Memorial Day parades. Lynchings were a regular occurrence, and they were celebrated. Families brought picnic dinners to watch it, and it was public. They were published in the newspapers, and that was also in the North as well as the South. And then, of course, the Jim Crow laws were strictly enforced in the South, keeping the blacks and whites pretty much separated in every city. So this was the environment in which this Tulsa massacre occurred. And it occurred in the same way that many of the lynchings everywhere else started. In this case, rumors of a young black man inappropriately touching a young white woman escalated quickly and with unfounded truth into rumors of rape. Well, that created a white mob that showed up at the jail and was calling for the release of the prisoner to lynch him. And in this case, the black men of the Greenwood neighborhood decided that enough was enough, and many of them had served in World War I and had guns left over from the war, and they armed themselves and also went downtown to meet with the white mob. So you have a white mob meeting a black mob, both armed, a shot went off from somewhere, and all chaos and mayhem started up. There was essentially a stalemate as night fell on each side of the tracks. But by morning at 5 a.m., a siren went off, which was the signal for the thousands of white armed men that had gathered on their side of the tracks to enter into the Greenwood neighborhood with a scorched earth policy. They went house to house, business to business, and looked for anybody they could find who hadn't already fled down Greenwood Avenue up into the hills to escape. And you heard an account earlier of there were airplanes in the air, shooting at the people as they were fleeing. And in some cases, there were accounts of them dropping glass bottles of kerosene to try to spread the fire throughout the neighborhood. When they'd find residents come out of their houses or businesses, if there was any indication that they were trying to resist or any kind of slight provocation, they shot them dead in the street. Otherwise, they rounded them all up at the baseball stadium, thousands of them, and they had to have a white Tulsan come and vouch for them because many of these people worked in the white side of town. At the end of the day, 36 square blocks of this neighborhood burned to the ground. Think about it. How big is 36 square blocks in your town? It's pretty significant. This was the home to 10,000 African Americans. There were numerous thriving businesses at the time. In fact, there was a burgeoning middle class, and it had been dubbed by the New York Times as the Black Wall Street because they had the highest per capita income for a black neighborhood anywhere in the country. The human carnage of the massacre was unbelievable. There are 300 documented dead, a few white, mostly black. But there were rumors at the time of mass graves that no one really wanted to look into until very recently. They're being unearthed and trying to account for some of the people who had died, probably 1,000. Many, many, many fled that day into the hills and ended up leaving forever and never returned to Tulsa. But what's even worse is that this story was untold for almost a century. The initial accounts, it was decided to blame it on the blacks, these uppity blacks, because if they hadn't armed themselves and came down to try to rescue one of their own, and if they had just minded their own business, none of this would have happened, of course. No one was ever held accountable for it anywhere, and there were never any reparations to help rebuild or make amends for anything. But there was incredible secrecy. The blacks, of course, were scared that if they brought it up or tried to make a fuss, it would happen again. Many whites were very, very embarrassed that something of this magnitude would happen in their community. But then at the time, let's remember that many of the whites that drove into that neighborhood as a mob were prominent citizens of town, and they wanted to avoid the repercussions. So I don't want to go into all the details here. I would invite you to get the book that I quoted earlier. It's The Burning, The Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921 by Tim Madigan. Or there's numerous documentaries. In fact, some of them have just come out to commemorate the 100th anniversary. Just search Tulsa Massacre. There's some great ones on the History Channel. MSNBC did a series, so did CBS and other outlets as well. What I want to do today is talk about the theological questions. My virtual inner fellowship group in May did see one of these documentaries, and we talked about it. And in that documentary, there was one woman, a survivor who was a child at the time, described what was going on in horrific detail. And she kept repeating, how could people be so mean? She pointed out that they knew these white people, their attackers. Many of them were servants in their homes or worked cleaning their businesses. It wasn't too hard to figure out who was under the hood. In fact, most of them did it without even hiding themselves at the time. And she kept asking, how could people be so mean? Which is a deep theological question for Unitarian Universalists, because we like to pride ourselves that we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of everyone, which means we believe that people are innately good. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have choices, and that we can't move more towards the good side or the dark side that's inherent in each of us. And this Tulsa massacre was clearly a horrible example of people succumbing to the dark side of human behavior. Now, maybe it was driven by the fear and intense racism of the times. That doesn't excuse it. It just might be an explanation. But the massacre itself, the mob behavior, is clearly a large group of people succumbing to the dark side all at once and feeding on each other. But even when the smoke drifted away and all the ashes had settled, there was almost a century of hiding the truth, the untold story of the Tulsa massacre, and that's almost as bad as the massacre itself. So the theological question I want you to ponder today and through the next week is, to what power are Unitarian Universalists ultimately held accountable to? And I would say, in this case, the power of truth. For centuries, our theological ancestors never bought into whatever they were told they had to believe. We were always the most cantankerous folks to go out there and prove it to ourselves, to think about it, to search for that truth and meaning. In fact, that attitude and that theological history is what had drove our fourth principle today, that we lift up and we say that we believe in a free and responsible truth, search for truth and meaning. Now, most of us hear that and we think, well, of course, I have all these world religions and everything in our six sources to freely ponder and go through to think about if it has meaning to me and where's the truth in there and how do I define spiritual truth or ethical truth for myself. But in this case, it's talking about the truth in society, the truth of justice. And you kind of have to pair that fourth principle with our sixth principle, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. Now, I assume a lot of you are like me. You sit in the pew or the chair on Sunday morning and we talk about these principles in very heady terms. And you're very proud of yourself that you're part of an organization that believes in such things. But we know it really doesn't come to life until the rubber hits the road and we do something with it. So in this case, it's all about having that responsible search for truth and meaning, telling the story, knowing the truth, to help build that world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. Knowing the truth and keeping it hidden does not build that world community. It's a theological imperative of action. So how do we live into that theology? I'm going to show you a short video of someone who I believe is a great example of living into that theology. Her name is Judy Goldsmith, She's a longtime active member of the Open Circle Fellowship in Fond du Lac, one of the three fellowships I serve. Now, you may know the name because you were a UW Stevens Point student at the time she went there. Or maybe you took a class from her when she was an English professor, or she's also the retired dean of UW Fond du Lac. But the name Judy Goldsmith probably rings a bell in her most public job that she ever had. From 1982 to 1985, she was the president of the National Organization for Women during the Reagan era. And so Judy is such an asset to both our fellowship and the Fond du Lac community because her vast experience and chutzpah, basically, to get something done. So I'm going to let her tell her story of how she told untold stories.
The Humanity Project, Telling the Untold Story, began on the day Freddie Gray died. It was April 19th in 2015. Freddie Gray was a Black man who lived in Baltimore. He was walking down a city street that day when some police officers stopped him and searched him, though they had no reason to suspect him of anything, although they claimed later that he had a small knife on him. They beat him brutally. Then they half-dragged, half-carried him to the police van. There was video of all of this. One officer held him up by each shoulder. His head was hanging down and his feet dragged motionless on the ground. When they got him to the van, they pushed him inside. He was handcuffed behind his back, and he had no way to stabilize himself inside the van. But the police nevertheless gave him what was known as a rough ride, meaning that they sped through the streets of Baltimore, taking the corners at high speed as he was tossed around inside the van. When they got to the police station, he was unresponsive, so they took him to the hospital, where he was pronounced dead of spinal injuries and a broken neck. The Black community in Baltimore reacted as you might expect. They rose up in anger and demonstrated and burned some buildings. As this was going on, I heard some people here locally say, "Oh, for heaven's sake, slavery ended 200 years ago. Why don't they just get over it?" And I thought, really? Do people really think that after slavery ended, everything was just fine? Yes, it was clear that they did. Our schools taught very little, if anything, about the realities of Black people's lives and history, other than the fact that there was slavery and it was bad. Beyond that, there was virtually nothing about what happened after slavery, or during for that matter, or the Jim Crow period, and the near absolute denial of civil rights, including the voting suppression that went with that. There was also some coverage of the later civil rights movement and Dr. King, but all that, but nothing since then. And after that period, things were relatively quiet, so most white people assumed that everything was okay. So clearly, people had to learn about that history and what really happened, because our lack of knowledge, our ignorance, was hurting people. We had to learn about these realities so that more of us would be motivated to help stop the violence and the terrible discrimination. So some friends and I quickly got together and formed what we called the Humanity Project, Telling the Untold Story. We were a very diverse group. We were Black, Latina, Indigenous, Hmong, and white, both male and female. We developed programming for a once-a-month evening meeting of community people with video programs, other supplementary materials, and lots of freewheeling discussion. The programs were free, and light refreshments were served during the two-hour program. And from the beginning, we began to add the study of lives and histories of other people of color as well, because it was clear that there was much people didn't know. Our planning meetings were exciting as we developed the program and in many cases began to learn some of those histories that we hadn't been familiar with ourselves. Our first full meeting was in September of that year, 2015, and it was a huge success. We had close to 100 people for the launch meeting, and the reception was enthusiastic. So there was definitely interest. We were off to a great start, but we soon ran into some logistical problems that we couldn't overcome. The first few months and years were great, and people responded enthusiastically to the programming, often commenting that they had no idea what had happened to people of color in our history, and that they wished we could make the program available more widely. But that was our problem. It was difficult to get people to come out for a monthly program for a number of reasons, including other obligations, the fact that we could hold only one program a month, bad weather, small children that we offered childcare, and others. So just before the beginning of the fourth year, it was clear that the program could no longer be sustained, and it ended. But then after a few years, a wonderful thing happened, even though it came out of the deadly disaster of the pandemic. It was, of course, Zoom, the great technological advancement that rapidly became a major means of communication as we were all quarantined and could no longer get to meetings in the traditional way. And with the advent of that new technology, a new group of people from our community, including some members from the original group, got together and began the new improved Humanity Project. They were smart, resourceful people, absolutely dedicated to spreading the untold story to more and more people. With Zoom, the attendance now has risen to 165 members, currently, as we approach the end of this first year. As I said at the beginning, Freddie Gray's death shocked me into action and to an understanding that we were dealing with a great deal of ignorance and that ignorance never serves us well. And we also believed, as Edward Martineau, an English 19th century philosopher, said, we are each of us responsible for the evil we might have prevented. We are each of us responsible for the evil we might have prevented.
We are each of us responsible for the evil we might have prevented. That's quite a quote. We are each of us responsible for the evil we might have prevented. I'm glad Judy gave me that quote, but I do want to point out that I think she misnamed who said it. It was James Martineau, an English philosopher. In fact, he was an English Unitarian philosopher and had a lot of influence on Unitarian theological thinking in England in the 19th century. I want to go back to the reading that I started with that talked about the launch of the series Watchmen. It closed with that newspaper scrap in the street that had the headline, "To Lynch Negro Tonight." Behind that headline is another untold story that's indirectly tied to Unitarians, and I think it needs to be told. It's the story of the Tulsa Tribune newspaper and its owner and chief editor, Richard Lloyd Jones. Now, Richard Lloyd Jones was the son of a very prominent and famous Unitarian minister in Chicago, Reverend Jenkins Lloyd Jones. Now, Jenkins Lloyd Jones spent his life in the Unitarian Church in Chicago in neighborhoods trying to work with immigrant communities and helping to build those that are historically marginalized. He was very much a universalist, looking at world religions and trying to have us communicate in interfaith ways. And probably his most famous endeavor was to have a boat of peace activists sail to Copenhagen, Denmark, right before World War I started at a conference to try to avert a world war. He was unsuccessful, of course, but it is something that he was very prominently known for. So Richard Lloyd Jones, his son, grew up in such an environment where you were a family that really reached out to others. You cared about the world. You cared about those who are marginalized. But yet he owned the Tulsa Tribune that constantly, and he's the one that wrote editorials that constantly pointed out how African Americans were subhuman people, that the Greenwood neighborhood was nothing more than a den of iniquity and it should be wiped out and the people should be put somewhere else. And so when this incident happened, these rumors started between this African American young man and this white young woman, it's he who created the rumor that it had actually been a rape that caused the white mob to form and set it all off. It's a story of abandoning his responsible truth for search for truth and meaning, and rather using fake news for personal gain at the expense of the entire African-American Greenwood neighborhood. He may not have been directly responsible for the massacre because he was probably in bed that night, but he certainly poured gasoline on the combustible climate that existed at the time and he may as well have handed the white mob a box of matches. It's a case in which someone very influential could have chosen to tell the truth, to take on the responsibility of preventing an evil, but he didn't. Now, there's another twist to this. In the very same year as the massacre, 1921, he was the co-founder and president of a new Unitarian congregation in Tulsa, All Souls Church. Now, All Souls Tulsa is the largest congregation that meets physically in the United States today. And it has essentially tried to do something about this reputation of one of their founders once they found out about it themselves a couple decades ago. They have been leaders in the community to tell the untold stories and to work for systemic change, to try to have to reconcile what happened with the massacre and to try to bring the Black community and the white community together so that they can live peaceably together and flourish. In fact, they've made a dramatic move in the last few years. They voted about 5 years ago to leave the white suburban neighborhood that they've been in since the 1950s, when they moved from downtown, sort of in that white flight movement that happened to all major cities. They needed to build on, but rather than build on, they've chosen to move back downtown. They have an entire city block right next to the Greenwood neighborhood. And in fact, they're dedicating a significant portion of the property that faces the Greenwood neighborhood to create a memorial garden to honor the victims of the massacre. It's their way of trying to build reconciliation into their theology and speaking their truth and letting it be told. I want to close with one slight digression. The music today. It has been purposely chosen because I wanted to lift up the resilience of the African-American people who have lived on this continent for 400 years and has faced unrelenting massacres like this over and over and over again. And so you can't tell this story without acknowledging the resilience of these people. We heard the Morehouse College Glee Choir singing We Shall Overcome, and we are going to close with a recording, a video of hymn number 149, Lift Every Voice and Sing, the Black National Anthem. And this video is particularly important because it was created for the historic African-American Church inaugural ball of President Barack Obama in Washington, D.C., January 18th, 2009. So please, listen with your soul. I close with this hope. May we continue to work for a world without untold stories of evil, and one in which stories of resilience, peace, justice, and true liberty for all are proclaimed in the news. Amen.